It's those two assholes. Those two idiots you saw me talking to at the third rail.
Just he doesn't want to touch the third rail.
That's, you've hit the third rail for sure.
That is the third rail, saying white people have interest.
Third rail. The third rail here is another wonderful show on our on the TRS network.
And it's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
It's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
Watch out for the third rail, baby. That's high voltage.
And the opinion of this reporter, if this nation, or in fact the world, ever needed heroes, that time is now. That time is now.
Like the king of all boomers, trying to reverse mortgage Trump Tower before the corona gets in, this is happening. Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 171 of the most huggable podcast, not just in the distant right, but possibly ever. I'm your host, Bellerophon, and joining me in the co-captain's chair, we've got Dharma King, the gentleman who always said, oh, you go ahead, man. The intro.
I was just going to say hello to all my froggy friends.
That's all we can ask for. And besides, I have seen folks quieting down on the meme that you actually are an Indian. So I do think we need to push that a little bit.
This is
bit
very
further.
Deep. I'm sorry. This is a big problem. Yes. Well, we'll see. Anyway. Hail, everybody.
Hey. All right. And also joining us, nobody in the audience tell him that Baudrillard was just a simulation this entire time. We've got Borzoi. How's it going, sir?
That's all right. How's it going? Actually, the funny thing is when Baudrillard died, I think it was The Guardian, they did his obituary and they actually said that Baudrillard's simulacrum had passed.
Were they even aware, I guess, of the joke they were making?
Yeah, no, they were well aware of the joke they were making. They tried to do an obituary that they felt would have been very fitting for his death. And Baudrillard was known, actually, to have a very cheeky sense of humor. The interviews with his wife is very illuminating, and a friend of his about the type of person he was.
Well, that's good to know. He just didn't write dense tomes that I have trouble reading. But thankfully, you've got you on hand to give me the TLDR so I can remain as grug as possible.
I am the grug whisperer. I do what I can.
I think I see a reality show in the making, potentially. All right. Well, hey, if you don't mind, Borzoi, since we got you on the mic already, run us through your table of contents you got for us today.
Well, we might also want to mention that we are supposed to have a guest, and he's currently trying to get his audio set up. So you might have a random voice that cuts in once it's all ready to go. We want to mention who it is. I think we already promoted it. Yeah, it's the representative of Antelope Hill Publishing.
So yes, sir. That's him.
Hopefully we get him on later. But I don't really have anything planned, so I kind of threw this up on the fly. My winner is, well, me. My loser is, what do I have here? Oh, QAnon. And my topic is this very interesting piece I found in Tablet Magazine about I had never even heard of this media app. The exclusive social media app Clubhouse had an anti-Semitic meltdown over Yom Kippur.
Ha ha! Well, I'm sure we'll learn about well, that.
That sounds like something that's very pertinent to my interests on a lot of levels.
I'm interested in anti-Semitic meltdowns.
But yeah, DK, what you got for us, man?
I don't know if I have a. I guess we could say my winner is coronavirus. My loser is Julato Bernstein. And my topic, I actually went through political theology, which I highly recommend that anybody with an interest in Schmidt or political science generally read if they haven't already. I had not. Hopefully we'll get a chance to discuss that at least a little bit, although I mean, I know we're also talking about dedicating an entire episode of something to that. But barring that, or in the absence of that, Emily Ratajkowski, or I don't know exactly, she, this Jewish so-called supermodel, had an interesting little piece that actually got quite a lot of play in normie media a few, like, it, I guess it was published on September 15th, but it's been, I guess the news cycle has been so crazy since then that it kind of got lost a little bit. But I remember it making something of a splash a few weeks ago, and it's still kind of, I've seen, you know, like updates on it in certain outlets as of a couple of days ago. So I think there's some things about it that are maybe worth, I mean, it's all mostly just bias confirmation, but you know, I like having my biases confirmed, and I think our audience does too.
I suspect I speak for the audience and everybody on the call when I say, I don't like having my biases confirmed. I fucking love it. So
yeah.
All right. And I just got confirmation from TV's Frank that we do have Louie, the representative from Antelope Hill Publishing, up on the mic now. So Louie, if you wouldn't mind, say hey to the audience for us. Let us know what you got.
Hey guys, I sound all right?
Yeah,
sounds, you sound perfect. Great.
Awesome. So my topic is obvious. It's the company Antelope Hill and our current endeavors. I did hear you mention C.J. Miller's excellent translation of Political Theology, and there's more. He's got more coming. My winner for the week is the Taliban, and my loser is NATO. And those are not really.
And it feels like 2004 all over again.
Yeah. All right. Yep.
The Afghanistan war never ended. Oh wait, yeah, actually,
it never happened, bro.
It never happened either.
Yeah.
Did not take place. The Afghanistan war did not take place.
Is it like Schrodinger's Middle East war? You know, it simultaneously never stopped but never began.
Well, if CNN doesn't look at it, is it a war? You know?
Yeah. It doesn't exist and it never ended.
It doesn't exist until you observe it.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
All right.
Do you want to go first with that? Y'all finished the table of contents or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We just, I was just about to chime in. The only thing I had, because I wanted to leave plenty of time, you know, for Louie to shill all the fine books and, you know, give us a little bit of an intellectual rundown on some of their offerings. So, you know, the only topic that I have is a curiously titled NPR piece. Is it time to say RIP to POC? And no, it's not a call for Exto. It's just talking about the term POC. And apparently it's not woke enough nowadays. And there's just some funny quotes and, you know, just, again, more bias confirmation.
Is this, I mean, just to like, maybe I'm ruining the shot here, but is the shot or whatever, that's not, whatever. Is it because Asians outperform Blagues?
You know, they don't mention it. But you can tell how they kind of dance around it. And they've also, they just kind of talk about how, you know, as a proud black man, you know, I look in the mirror and I don't see POC, you know, I don't see African American. I see black and things like that about how it discounts the black experience or whatever.
Who so knew NPR doing? Stood for National Purge Radio?
Well, it sounds like they're doing a Niccolo Salo versus Richard Spencer, like, the, you know, I'm not white, I'm Croatian or something. Or I don't know. I guess we'll check it out when we read the article.
Yeah, I'm not white, I'm black. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you'd like, since it's already on the tip of our tongues, yeah, let's just dig into it. It's a nice kind of palate cleanser before we get into something a little bit deeper. So so one of the things that I learned, they introduced the term BIPOC, so I guess BIPOC in the article.
BIPOC, we know.
Niggas is gay or bisexual, I guess, right? Yeah.
Yeah, precisely. And I'm not going to lie, DK, just like you thought, I thought it was, I would see that occasionally on Twitter, right? I thought it meant like, you know, gender queer, like bisexual persons of color. I thought that's what they were driving at. But no, it's apparently stands for black, indigenous, and, you know, persons of color. They just throw the catch all there at the end. And, yeah, you know, it's kind of a fluff article. It doesn't really broach any subjects that are new. Really, the only thing that's notable about it is they kind of dance around in a really, really inartful way the Asian question, which is like, you know, Asians like manage to not go to jail and, you know, have jobs and stuff.
Do you remember the old form of this term? It wasn't BIPOC. This is kind of if you've been like on these kind of circles a while, you'll remember POCLA, which was the they stopped using It's POC less Asians. So like minus Asians.
All right. Well, they, in which case,
took that for,
if it's if it's POC LA, then you know, good news to good news to Borzoi. Then, if our resident Chinaman, you know, you can you can stay with us.
I, on the other hand, am pure Aryan.
Yeah, Indo-Aryan Alliance. You know, in this case, emphasis on the Indo.
Are they bringing back NAM, non-Asian minority? Is this where they're going with this?
Oh yeah, that was another one. Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, the whole thing I saw. Sorry, go on.
Oh no, no, you got it. You got it, man.
I was just gonna say, I think it was it was a Steve Saylor retweet, but and I mean, I don't think this is news to anyone, but just to emphasize, the content was basically like, the 20th century was the century of physics, and Western Europeans, you know, or whatever, Europeans generally are not afraid of physics. White people are not afraid of physics, and so white people dominated. The 21st century is shaping up to be a century of biology or genetics, and for kind of really ridiculous historical reasons that come down to losing a war, European people are deathly afraid of genetics and refuse, absolutely refuse to engage on the question in any meaningful way. And we're, as in opposition to that, or the Chinese are not at all afraid of, you know, CRISPRing themselves into super soldiers, etc. And that's going to be an issue.
to put it mildly, yeah. And you know, all of the all the pearl clutching, you know, that America has had, maybe it's a front, maybe it's a sincere thought process, right? But all the pearl clutching, you know, this was around like 2005, 2010, about like stem cell research. What are the moral implications? You know, what are the implications for like being a human being, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you know, the Chinese have approximately zero of those concerns. I'd be willing to bet, you know, just all of the shekels in Israel right now that they're probably like snatching up, you know, Chinese orphans out of like, you know, some crime-riddled province just to run CRISPR tests on them.
Oh, I mean, you know, the organ harvesting of prisoners is, you know, they've been doing that for decades. So, yeah, you know, and they have no qualms. It's been a recurring theme in recent episodes of Myth of the 20th Century that, you know, and I mean, this is one of those things that should be obvious, but maybe it isn't, that the United States used to be in some ways similar to China. In that regard, that, you know, there was an understanding of like, well, look, this is a civilization state. Things are very, you know, you need to have a certain level of expendability of your like human capital in order to achieve greatness. And, you know, if that means we want to build the Hoover Dam, for example, then, you know, yeah, it's going to be very difficult. And maybe, you know, the safety standards, like, I don't think the Hoover Dam, leaving aside the kind of environmental impact side of things, which is in a way part of the same story, but even just in terms of things like liability insurance or safety standards for occupational whatever, we don't, you know, we don't value the achievement of the goal anywhere near well enough to have the kind of, because it involves sacrifices, it involves offsets, and we're just not willing to make those trade-offs, at least as things stand.
Yeah, and not only liability, right, but to say nothing of OSHA. You know, all the tradesmen I know, you know, could wax poetic about how about 20% of what OSHA does is probably useful and probably protects all the workers.
Yeah, that's the other side of it. Yeah, and then the like other how much of these things even, right, exactly. And then of course there's all the tricks and the lawsuits and just trying to, you know, essentially looting phase type stuff that's happening that has nothing to do with, you know, actually protecting anybody. It's just purely a way to grift off the system. yeah, it's really sad. But
you know what the new term they're going to go with is? It's non-Asian minority blacks, Latinos, and Amerindians, or NAMBLA.
I see what you did there, and given how it seems like you know, we're getting more and more open pedophilia in our culture and, you know, in our elite class, it might be more apropos than you even realize. And I will say, too, to round back out to DK's point, you know, in case the listeners are worried, you know, make no mistake. We at the Third Rail, we sacrifice all manner of workers, orphans, fellow podcasters, you know, just to put out a good product. You know, we're not bound by any OSHA standards, and we have no problem, you know, with all the mass industrial accidents that happen behind the scenes.
The CEO of racism busted up our union.
Oh, man. Does that mean Miles is out of a job?
We'll see. I mean, we're figuring out how we can fix this problem. But unfortunately, it seems like we have been sufficiently broken and many of our racism's outsourced so that we can't organize effectively anymore.
Well, in which case, you know, I guess we'll. I'm not sure what options we have, you know, but yeah, we're in the equivalent of a TRS, like Amazon podcasting warehouse. You know, we don't get bathroom breaks. They're just cracking the whip 24/7, no overtime, no benefits. You know, so, you know, this is, you know, we're just thankful to have a job in these trying times.
I do miss that dental plan though.
You know, as do I, you know, mandatory Tindy breaks, the whole nine yards. Or when vaping was popular, you know, we got every hour on the hour, you know, you got 5 union approved pulls on your vape before you had to go back to the job. Those are the golden eight. Those are the golden days.
And I can't wait to tell my child about the things that we used to have.
Yeah. Well, given, you know, given the way things are going, you know, some of those things might include like electricity. Or, you know, running water.
I forgot. What were we even talking about?
The get rid of BIPOC. Or no, get rid of POC.
Get rid of POC, you say?
Yeah, again, they could have phrased the article title, I think, a little bit better. But yeah, I wanted to kind of put a bow on that.
The only way they could have made that worse is if they had titled it, "Is it time to liquidate the term POC?" Or is it time to liquidate PSC? That would have made the joke work better.
Liquidation, ovens, electrified floors. There's many ways you could deal with this.
Is it time to peacefully sunset POC?
Actually, is it time to take POC, you know, up to a farm upstate where you'll never see them again? But I did want to just put a bow on that, you know, unless anybody had any concluding thoughts. They had some deeply insightful thoughts, you know, from some members of the BIPOC community. There was one there, it was kind of boring, from like a half, you know, from a HAPA about privilege, blah, blah, blah. The ones that were really good were from black guys. And there was one where he chimes in, "I have no idea how to say BIPOC. I heard it pronounced BIPOC like Tupac. But I just woke up one day and the whole internet was using it. And I'll tell you this, I hate it, man." From Mr. Ryan Blocker.
Yeah, and, I mean, right? Like, that's, I think, part of the humiliation aspect of the whole thing we're in is we're, you know, all of a sudden everything changes and you're expected to, you know, it's the chic thing to use the new terminology and you look stupid, I mean, at least according to them, if you don't. You know what the thing is that we say now that didn't exist 6 months ago.
Yeah, well, it's like you know, it's
and
like
if that's hard for like high IQ white guys, imagine for like low agency, you know, black people.
Yeah,
and there's even a quote to that effect.
Not 2 weeks ago, that's how far back they are. By a black guy, he said, "Hey, brother man," and I was like, "That's like for a young black guy." I had no idea. But they just ignore modern terminology. They don't care.
Well, so they're returning to tradition in a sense, I guess. Their grugness is a shield. Maybe we should take some lessons. Well, you know, except for the crime and rape and what have you. but yeah, to DK's point, right, about like them being behind the curve or what have you, or not caring, there is one young woman who I suspect is heavily melanated. You know, she chimes in, and I get irritated, not irritated, vexed when people refer to me as POC or by POC. Like, no, absolutely not. I'm black. Don't play me. And, you know, that's and that's their that's their thoughts on the subject, right? Like, you know, do they even give a damn? Probably not.
Well, you also you do have like the Tariq Nasheed types as well, where they first of all among blacks themselves, they refer to themselves as ADOS, the Americans descendants of slaves. That's what it means, and they use that to differentiate themselves even from African blacks because of the immigration issue and the different experience that American blacks have had. And then you also have the other aspect where they, in fact, actually, you know how on our side of things, people sometimes might talk about like a red-brown alliance. If, you know, is such a thing even possible? Our enemies do all kind of like scare campaigns about it. Well, on the Tariq Nasheed circle of blacks, they argue against the black and brown alliance. They do not see themselves in the same struggle or on the same side as Latinos, and it's understandable why that there are blacks that feel that way, especially since they got basically, after Compton got ethnically cleansed of our people, now Compton's being ethnically cleansed of them by the Latinos, by the Hispanics. So, I mean, there are more than a few blacks that chafe at the idea of having to share a special term with other minorities because they are well aware they're going to get the short end of the stick on many things.
Well, it's not just projecting into the future. I mean, look, I'm not a Castizo futurism is a funny meme, but the blunt political reality of the situation facing the United States is, you know, we're barring some kind of truly revolutionary action that is just, I think, not going to happen. The whites becoming a plurality, but dipping below 50% in terms of absolute numbers of the population is locked in and may already be here depending on the precise number of illegal immigrants and just how accurate the census is and so on. Obviously, the next biggest chunk of the population is mestizos, Hispanics. And, you know, right now, as things stand, they're kind of and Steve Saylor comments on this all the time that, you know, that, like, they're not very vocal. They're not very loud. They don't make the same kind of demands, and they don't have the same kind of catering as yet, and for the most part, that the blacks do. They're certainly not this kind of moral center of gravity for the left, the way that blacks are. But I very much expect that's going to change. I mean, there may be some of this, you know, a phenomenon that we've discussed before of, you know, the Republican Party trying to in a last ditch effort to avoid becoming, you know, to do anything but other than serve as a center of gravity for white people, to pitch to probably Indians, maybe Chinese and Hispanics, and put together a kind of relatively high agency brown people coalition. Possibly show title, I don't know, relatively high agency brown people coalition. Anyway, point is or certainly, I mean, in any case, relative to high agency relative to blacks, right? But the inevitable result of that is going to be, like, I think in the America of the 2030s and possibly into the 2040s, I mean, although at that level, you know, who knows sort of what happens, I think you are going to see essentially like blacks are just going to be the big losers because they're holding on to all this valuable urban real estate. They are a massive just drain and waste on the entire system, which is being held up by functionally free debt. But as Russia and China put together an alternative to the SWIFT system for international finance, as barrels of oil start being traded in currencies other than US dollars, which has already started to happen and is likely to accelerate. Probably, I mean, I think there's already barrels of oil being traded in Chinese yuan. I really don't think that the position of, as you say, ADOS, you know, American descendants of slaves, black people, American blacks, is going to be tenable in the way that it is now. And so mm-hmm. one thesis that I've seen that I really think has something going on with it is this is kind of the last gasp. Like what we're seeing this summer in terms of agitation from the black community is, you know, this is their like last best shot at getting some gibbs before the hammer comes down.
Yeah. Although they'll still be used as shock troops and a vanguard.
Of course, of course.
I just want to give a shout out to some of the people in the chat. So Zoomer Imperator, political theorist Frank Quise, Parkington Yaki advocated for a black-brown alliance. And what was the other one? and turncoat tradition, because Tisos just wanted barbacoa.
That's hilarious.
That's a good one.
All right. Not bad. Not bad.
yes, Frankie's Yaki, yo.
Yes. Well, to put a bow, I guess, on what you were talking about, DK, right? Like, if they, you know, in the event that, you know, the Black Americans, BIPOC, whatever you want to call them, you know, that they reach the end of their viability, you know, for Zog, for the system to use them, you know, what does it look like? Do they get to start their own count of countries that they got kicked out of? You know, they got kicked out of Africa, you know, sold into slavery over here. They get kicked out of America. You know, it's only a matter of time maybe before they work their way up to 109.
What if black people really are the real Israelites?
Well, if they start getting,
that's,
you know, if
bullshit,
they
get, but I believe it.
I will admit, I'm more than willing to entertain the Black Hebrew Israelite thesis, if only because those guys are fucking hilarious, and it is an item on my bucket list to try to interact with them in the wild. Just, I don't know, see if I can't get them to roast me.
Well, it's my wife's had an interaction with them before where she didn't know, she had never encountered the Black Hebrew Israelites before, and she wanted to get one of their pamphlets, and the guy just looked at her and was like, it's not for you. she was very crestfallen and disappointed that they wouldn't give her, because she likes to collect. She collects controversial books, so she was just genuinely, like, she wasn't even doing it as like an irony thing. She just genuinely wanted one of their pamphlets, and they refused to give her one.
Well, shouldn't she have told the gentleman in question, right? Like, no, my husband says all the time, if you see it, it's for you.
I think that might have been too confusing for them.
Oh, fair enough. Also, I'm seeing a lot of Das Rights in the chat.
Yes.
My favorite bit of lexicon, I think, from, you know, like just the last several years of dissident vocabulary is Das Right. And I will admit there has been a few times, you know, in the 9-to-5 normie job setting where I may have accidentally let out a Das Right and had to hastily explain myself to a coworker. But anyways, you know, just I don't want to eat up all the time on my singular topic. You know, do we have any concluding thoughts on, you know, that NPR article before we move on to what Borzoi has?
I just want to say one thing, which is, you know, I've quoted Steve Saylor a lot, and I'll do it again. The only thing holding together the coalition of the miserable is hatred of white people. And in some ways, I think we can take not a lot, but some small amount of heart from the fact that they're having this issue. They're having this discussion. They're kind of before they've, you know, according to the official statistics, even gotten white people below 50% of the American population, already they're fracturing amongst themselves. That's good. That's good for us.
Hell, they don't, even they want to segregate from each other.
I'm seeing now the chat's saying Das Reich, and now we have the handshake of Das Reich and Das Right. Yes, few speak of the Das Reich and the Das Right Alliance.
Well, depending on what keywords might you know might might get auto showed from you know from the podcast service, you know, Das Reich might be up there.
Okay,
the chat is fire today.
So what was the next you want to Louis, you want to talk a little about Antelope Hill?
Sure, I can do. I do have a lot. We solicited questions on our Twitter account. So maybe at the end I'll just like a run through all those. But I kind of just wanted to
Sounds
give
perfect.
Our Yeah, maybe I'll do that at the end, or I could also answer chat questions too. But so in terms of, you know, talking points, if you want to, so obviously I'm sure you know what we are. We're a publishing house. We do a lot. We're all about preservation in hard copies. The kind of genesis of it was having a, you know, a hard drive full of awesome PDFs, and then not ever reading them because they're PDFs and they suck to read, and you know, some of them are of low quality. And
on that note, are you going to be publishing an edition of Sun and Steel?
Okay, so that's that came up. That's actually one of our questions. So Sun and Steel is currently still owned by, I believe it was Koshanda USA. They translated it, and they have the rights. Now, there are people that are not us who have done more fly-by-night stuff. If you want to do this, if you want to support the mission, there are things that are copyrighted that we can't access. If someone who's not us wanted to, say, get a Ingram Spark account or a Lulu account and crank out a bunch of those, that'd be cool. But then you get shut down pretty quick, but you get some. That's a good way to get hard drives out there if you don't mind going to the gray area. We don't want to do that kind of stuff because we have a bit of infrastructure. We've got people. But and there's plenty of works that are in the public domain or are sufficiently out of copyright or copyright's not being enforced or all kind of things that we can do. We actually got requests to do a bunch of we get a lot of requests to do works that are not in the public domain. We have made deals in the past to get that stuff done. It's not unheard of, and we're currently talking to some estates of authors and stuff. But that's kind of hush hush. We don't want to talk about what our legal reasoning is for a lot of these things.
Sure, sorry. Go on.
But yeah, but you know, I really wanted to do a publish some of Mishima's plays because he has some very interesting stuff. I'm sure you've all heard of My Friend Hitler, which I can't even find a copy of on PDF. For my own collection of PDFs. But yeah, as it stands, Koshanda USA holds all that stuff because Mishima was, you know, a mainstream guy, right? So a mainstream publisher holds all his stuff.
And he didn't even die until 1970, so...
Yes. No. Now, some authors like Leon DeGrelle have... Before they die, they put out like a, especially if they're more like a dissident sphere, they'll say, hey, if you can get this out there. The kind of wave copyright, like Leon DeGrelle did. Another thing is we do like to translate things. We have a lot of translation projects. A lot of people ask how they can help us. If you speak two languages, that's the kind of help we need. We're always looking for Russians and Frenchmen. And a couple Spaniards, but we need Russian and French probably the most most badly. If you are looking to help us, that's the best way. Also, we do original works, as I'm sure some of y'all have heard of. While we were on the show, I actually signed the contract to publish. Have y'all ever heard of Scott Howard? He's one of our original authors. We just signed. I was on the podcast, right now, and I signed my end of the contract, and he'd already signed it, so we're locked in to publish his book, The Upcoming Transgender Industrial Complex.
Fantastic. So we will publish. So, say for example, DK writes a DK book, then you can. I mean, obviously, it would have to be subject to editorial review, etc. But you would publish something like that.
Yes. Oh, someone asking, do we need Serbs in the chat? We're not actually against, you know, publishing. We don't have any projects in mind. If you came to us and said, hey, I speak this language, we need a Norwegian right now too, for one thing. But if you come to us and said, hey, I speak a language, we have this cool book, I want in English, we can work with you on that. But in terms of what we need, it's Russians, Spaniards, and French.
I got you. So two quick questions. One, how can people reach out? What's the best way to contact you if they can assist? And then two, you mentioned like original submissions. You know, hypothetically, let's say somebody out there had like a neo-Confederate Gundam manga that they wanted to get published. You know, what's the situation look like for that?
Okay, so we can publish works with a lot of pictures in them or illustration stuff or comic books. We have the ability to. We have the infrastructure in place. On our website, antelopehillpublishing.com, we have like a contact us or a submissions form. That's where you would go with that. You also can DM our Twitter account, but it's faster if you just go through the official submission guide. We have been getting quite a few submissions. We do have somewhat high standards, though, especially if we don't know you. So we've gotten some manifestos.
Oh, boy. I love nice. Those. Problem,
you have my interest, sir.
Yeah, the problem is, you know, if you come with a manifesto, we actually kind of as a joke, kind of not. If we do publish your manifesto, you have to agree not to commit any felonies ever, because holy moly, we don't want to be attached to something like that.
I feel like that's not an enforceable contract. Well, that may not be legally binding.
But at the very least, when they commit a felony, we can say they no longer work for us. You know?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, Bellerophon, now that you put it out there, you have to commit to doing Mobile Suit generally.
Oh man, you do not have to twist my arm on that one. I'm right after we get done here, you know, the mechas and the uwus will be hot and heavy, and it'll start almost immediately.
The Gundams of Hazzard, we're making it happen.
Yep. Oh, we also have, if I can go through what we have out for sale right now, we do have the collected works of Patrick Pearse. We have new translations of Carl Schmitt. We have the political theology and the theory of the partisan, which is more of a lecture series, but it works very well as a book that he gave. I believe it was the University of Madrid in the 60s, later in life, Carl Schmitt, about, you know, the origins of like irregular warfare and the political implications of it. We also have a book on we have Spain, Civil War, and World War, which is a kind of an old academic text about the Spanish Civil War. It's very neutral, like it's kind of dry actually. But if you want to know about like the lead up and the aftermath in a kind of big brain political sense, it's good for you. We of course have The Burning Souls by Leon Negril. We started this one because we wanted to find a copy of it or a PDF, and it just didn't exist in English. Although we'll note that Zero Schizo, I'm sure he's a friend of the show, or I think he's been on Third Rail, I think.
Yeah, he has been on Third Rail, he knows enough of us on here, so.
Yeah, a friend of the show, I guess you call him. So Zero Schizo did, a while back, he did a translation of The Burning Souls that we were looking at, and we're like, oh, maybe we'll publish this. And we did some work, we polished it up a little bit. And I don't, you know, and we also sent it to like some French speakers who had access to the originals, and they said, "Listen, we can do a better job than this. We can do it more true to the French." And I would like to thank Zero for kind of inspiring the project, but we ended up commissioning it from our French speakers instead, and I think it turned out very well.
Did you say you were looking for a Norwegian speaker, by the way?
Oh, we are. Yes.
Yeah. Is it for? I'm assuming for Knut Hamsun's works.
It is. Yes, we've got a lot. We got a lot of desire for Knut Hamsun. Also, we have our newest release is Wyndham Lewis's Hitler, which is an interesting book that he wrote right before the NSDAP took power. It's got a foreword by this guy named John Chapman. I think you've all heard of.
I've never heard of this gentleman yeah. named John Chapman. Tell me about him.
I believe he's Michigan based. He breeds Borzoi dogs, which is a weird thing. What are the odds? And he did the foreword for it, which is very good.
And, let me just be absolutely clear on this for the audience. That's just the pen name I use. I absolutely wrote the foreword for Wyndham Lewis's Hitler. So that's up for pre-order right now, correct?
That's up for pre-order, and it should be up for order soon. I believe, and if it, I, it's actually, I believe, if you're in Canada, it's already for pre-order on Amazon. Although the approvals process for Amazon is different.
So I have a question.
Just one thing I want to mention to the because the chat's mentioning the Hamsun's work should be readily available in English. There's one part, not all of his works are easily found in English, and there's one work in particular that the last translation on it was done around the 1960s, and they're deliberately not going to ever re-release or retranslate. You can get a copy, but it's really expensive if you want, but that's The Cultural Life of Modern America, which was a work that Homsun wrote, or that's where the Lotto Stud Farm passage comes from. It's a work he wrote very early on when he went to America and was unimpressed by what he saw. Homsun in his life later basically disavowed the work and because he thought it was too immature, and he also wanted to salvage his career as well, given what he would later get involved in. But it's not an easy to find work other than I purchased a copy of it, and I think it cost me like $40 to get a copy of it.
You know, on a similar note, we get a lot of people asking us to do that book by Scholz and Iskin towards the end of his life. That's very popular. There is a very, very active estate for him that will not let that book be published in any way, and aggressively takes down or attacks any kind of effort to publish.
Wait, which book? I'm sorry, I dropped out for a second there.
Yeah.
Which work? Do they refuse to put out there?
The one about 200 years by Scholz and Iskin.
Oh, yeah, 200 years. This one's going to need some work.
Yeah, that one's not happening.
That's why, because it's the estate itself that's going after. Yes, I didn't realize
that. Very aggressively, yes. That's just the way it is. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean, in terms of that gray market area, like, that basically precludes a legitimate, you know, ISBN numbered hard copy, but it does not preclude an organizational effort of people who speak Russian and, you know, English language editors to create a translated text. Now, distributing that text. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, well, an English version of it already. We looked into it, obviously, because the English version exists.
I know, but I understand that it's either incomplete or, you know, not very good, or both. I don't know if that's true or not. I've never tried to read it.
It was for a long time. There was a we had no involvement. I can't take any credit for this. It's Antelope Hill. I believe it was in 20. It was like that for a while. I believe in late 2018 there was a very good effort to bring it in French that is fairly complete or all the way. I haven't read through it. Obviously, it's very long. But
it's long, yeah.
I read the first few chapters and it seemed like it was legit, but obviously. Unpublished.
And that's so you said into French or into English?
From French into English. So it was translated
from French. Okay. See, that's also like kind of, I mean, not to, that kind of stuff can be better than nothing. But when possible, you always want to translate from, especially when you like have the original source language text. Obviously. You know, sometimes you don't, although if you're dealing with ancient materials, sometimes.
So you're not, you don't lose too much. It's not like it's poetry.
Sure.
Either. We do have some works in the pipeline that I can talk about. We've got a book on Russian volunteers in the Spanish Civil War. Different than the one, there's another company doing another Russian volunteer memoir. It's a different one. It's called Russian Volunteers in Spain. We have a thread on our Twitter. We're also doing a release on Mosley and the British Fascists. That's going to be very soon.
You should put out like a leather bound The Based Library by Antelope Hill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Deluxe leather bound editions.
Yeah.
Also, you mentioned your Twitter, but I was an idiot and had myself muted when I asked. But you know, for the audience, what's your what's the Twitter at?
At Antelope Hill. It's got our logo on it. Should be the only one like that. There's no imitators yet. We also do have some. Go ahead.
I'll go ahead and finish that. I have a really good question from the chat to ask you.
Okay. So we do have a lot of, we call them like associated or allied publishers. There's people doing the same work we do, that we like, that are only have a few books or they're somewhat well known. We don't consider them competitors because
that was my question was like, when are you and Mystery Grove good? I mean, I just want to see the cage match.
Well, the thing is, like, as it is, like, this milieu is, like, consumptive, kind of. And so the idea, like, no one's going to not buy our book because they bought their book, you know? Like, it's kind of that's just not a thing that people do, you know? It's not like there's finite, you know, people interested in these books. We just kind of don't, I think there's kind of obviously like a tacit agreement not to step on each other's toes. And if you liked Storm of Steel, we have in the works in a pipeline. I signed a contract for it last week. Some of Ernst Jünger's brother's works on nationalism that haven't been English yet, we're working on. They're very interesting. Obviously, they later disavow. It's interesting reading them because I read the first chapter. It's done, and you read it, and it sounds like something out of like the SS Party magazine, but it's written in 1923, and then the guy disavowed it, or disavowed the National Socialists. So it's very interesting. It's very interesting to read, but you see a lot of like there's basically demands for man of action and political movements based on action and youth. But they're obviously, like, you know, I guess you call them proto-fascist or proto-Nazi, but they're very interesting revolutionary conservative type works, and none of that stuff in English. The revolutionary conservatives didn't get much of their stuff translated.
So the chat asks, we got our European friends in the chat ask about shipping to the EU outside the UK. Is there any issues with that, or is there anything that they need to know?
Yes, that's a good, very good question. So if you're outside of the US, we do have certain titles available on Amazon that are like, you know, pretty optical. That's usually the best. If you're out of the US, Amazon's the best way to get our stuff. If you're in the US, obviously we make more money when you come to us directly. So basically if shipping to New York, we can do for the books that are less Amazon friendly, we can ship them out. It is just very expensive.
I know there's also legal issues potentially depending on the precise nature of the content and the precise country you're shipping to.
But that's not our problem. Well, if you say send it to me, I'll send it to you. Like that's if you get hemmed up on it, that's kind of your business. We really can't keep sure. abreast of every single nation's you know policy. We know that we can't send Leon de Grail to Belgium. Because it is prescribed. We consider making like boomery Facebook ads, like banned in Belgium, Leon de Grail's.
Read the work that the Belgians don't want you to see.
Yeah.
Chad also, by the way, asks if you guys need funding and if there's a way other than, I mean, I think they're talking about just straight donations. If you guys need funding, if there's any way to do that, if so.
So, so in terms of funding, this is kind of a hard one. So we do, not to give a reveal too much. We do have, investors, and if you come to us, we can maybe work something out, but we generally prefer to only do that with people who are very, you know, who we already know in person. And yes, someone in the chat said the packages are optical. Yes, the packages are very optical. It's a, you know, pretty standard fare for a book delivery. But yeah, if you want to, you know, give us money or help out, you can reach out through our contact form and maybe we can work something out. But we try to do things pretty by the book. We're not a charity. We're a for-profit company, you know.
I mean, just buy the books, yeah.
Yeah.
just if you want to help them out, just buy every single book they have and buy multiple copies for your friends.
Well, I will say I haven't read the most recent publications, but I read a big chunk of the Patrick Pearce in I forget which episode it was, and I guess it's gone now, but it doesn't matter. They're very much worth reading. If you're interested in politics, particularly dissident politics. And the history of dissident politics. I mean, you know, really, this is kind of multiple overlapping areas of interest in terms of, you know, if you're just our guy who wants to know more about, you know, the history of this stuff or even just the animating ideas and sort of different perspectives. It's definitely worth reading. It obviously makes a great gift for people in your pool party or, you know, people who are associated and so on. So yeah. And obviously, you know, if you're a for-profit company making a profit on every sale, then, you know, when you sell books, you make money and that also looks good in terms of boosting Amazon rankings or, you know, search, engine optimization and stuff like that.
Yeah. Now people, one guy actually did kind of do this. We haven't talked to him, but I think he wanted to help out because as soon as we launched I think it was Political Theology, he bought like 10 copies and then sent a message saying, hey, don't send me any of the copies. So we sent a bunch of coupon codes for the book that he can give out to his friends if he wants to. But yeah, I guess if you want to support us, that's also a method, is you can buy the book and we can send you coupon codes and you can give out or not give out. That's an option if you want to just like kind of backdoor us money. But we're not.
Sounds like something we could do for like a raffle for listeners or something, yeah. Maybe at some point.
I like it.
Yeah. I do also, if you're interested in buying damaged copies of books, we do have a couple damaged copies of books that if you want like cheap books, you can DM us and get some of those. We can work some out with that. We have that ability.
Well, along those lines as well, talking about giving books to friends, you know, giving them as gifts or what have you. One of the questions I had, I guess, like from the offerings you guys have, you know, there's a lot of folks who are just now getting into dissident politics with all the BLM riots and all that sort of stuff going on, you know, in 2020. Do you have anything in particular, like a particular title, you know, that you wanted to shill that you think would fit the bill for that would be really well suited for somebody, you know, either on the edge or who's just gotten into, the dissident sphere?
So if you're new, Patrick Pierce says a lot of things that apply to nationalist movements to this day. And it's very inspiring, especially if you're, of Irish heritage. It's a good one. Also, it's just the person, right? If they like World War II, they're going to like Leon DeGrill, you know? If they're a political science guy, if they're a recovering Ben Shapiro guy, you know, you want Carl Schmitt. You know, that's kind of the way it goes. In terms of accessibility, I think you got to kind of play to the person, right? Don't just, what are they interested in? You know, that's kind of the deal there. I can't give a, you know.
Well, I guess, if someone's interested in trains, for example, maybe there's something along those lines. Bad joke. You don't have to answer that.
Or cremation. No, what I will say is that the Patrick Pierce book was really soaring rhetoric. And I mean, there was definitely some interesting stuff happening in terms of sort of what he had to say. And particularly knowing some of the history of the Easter uprising and things like that, then it can certainly be, I guess, meaningful. And you could say, I don't know, philosophical terms or political scientific terms. But it is, I think, mostly kind of an inspirational text. Schmitt, by contrast, is quite dense and maybe difficult to wrap your head around and requires some foundation in something. I mean, I really enjoyed Political Theology. I mean, I didn't understand 100% all of the references because he cites many, many people. He's sort of it's very heavily discursive in terms of being placed in the kind of discourse of political science from the late 19th and early 20th centuries that, I'm not a part of. I think generally, yeah. You know, a lot of these people are, you know, kind of obscure even to specialists. And, but nevertheless, you know, I mean, he does talk, you know, he cites Kierkegaard and a lot of what's going on with, Schmitt has a certain kind of, foundation in romantic irony and literary criticism, which is something that I'm quite familiar with. And I found a lot of interesting resonances, with, actually some stuff that Derrida had to say, who's also drawing very heavily on that same kind of late 19th century romantic iron, the kind of literary criticism and romantic irony. And there's a wide range of different approaches and different things, and I'm excited. I haven't read the DeGrell yet. I'm waiting for your third run of your hardcovers to be published, because I definitely want a hardcover of that.
If you're gonna do Schmitt is huge brained. That's probably the first book I read in a while that I actually like political theology that I struggled with. Like, it's actually a difficult read if you're not super well versed. You have to be Googling things all the time. But if you want to get into Schmitt, I recommend The Theory of the Partisan. We have first. It's a lot more accessible. It's still pretty huge brained, but it's not like political theology. Political theology is referencing a lot of like reactionary thinkers that we don't even know about anymore.
Like, yeah, well, that's like, what, yeah, exactly. But I don't think you actually, I mean, I followed, at least I would like to think that I followed his argument, irrespective of the fact that I didn't really, I didn't know, you know, who was this, he kind of ends on this note of this Spaniard, but it's really, he talks about Bakunin and Satanism and anarchy and the relationship between,
it was very modern. It had come out just before his book did. It was, who was that French socialist that,
Proudhon.
Yeah, he was doing a lot of that.
Very famous, yes. I know Proudhon from the same kind of like Mallarmé and these kind of. It's like, it's funny because I haven't seen anything like this, but maybe this is something that I don't know. It's something that I think about and would probably be worth doing is charting like the intellectual history in terms of. So, for example, Heidegger is known in our circles for being a member of the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Known in philosophical circles for being a very important, figure
he's often lumped in with the existentialists.
Well, that's the thing is like, so Sartre takes Heidegger in one direction. Gadamer and Derrida take him what's his name? The other French, hermeneutician, the name escapes me at the moment, but doesn't matter. Take him in a kind of another direction. But even there, it's like, okay, well, Heidegger's coming out of, I mean, yes, he's doing really kind of advanced metaphysics coming from a kind of Hegelian perspective, but he's also doing a certain kind of, he's coming out of, he himself was a classically trained theologian, particularly in like biblical literary criticism. And so like you start like making these, maps or connections among like, okay, well, you have these, romantic poets, obviously, Goethe and Schiller and these people who are inspiring, Hegel and Hegel's responding to Kant and Heidegger's taking it in a different direction. And that's kind of in a more purely philosophical or, let's say transcendental dimension in a Kantian sense. But then you have a kind of political cash value of it. And that gets taken up by people like Schmidt, who's obviously very well versed. I mean, that's why I'm sure part of the reason why he's citing Kierkegaard is he's playing a little game there in terms of drawing out that connection and showing like, okay, well, here is like, one. It's like kind of the application of this very high flying abstract philosophy to very concrete political questions. I think one of the key takeaways of political theology is like Schmidt is always first and foremost concerned with the concrete and showing how the concrete escapes this regime of rationalization of abstraction that in many ways is coextensive, or at least on his reading of the liberal democratic project is coextensive with the liberal democratic project. Like for Schmidt, liberal democracy is about achieving orderly, regularly results without any kind of, you're trying to exclude so far as possible to banish the concept of sovereignty and being, having to decide in concrete terms. We're just going to punt all that responsibility onto this abstract system. And he's basically the whole tome. Well, tome, it's 67 pages. They're just extremely dense. But the whole thing is like, that doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And here's all the reasons why. Anyway, I'd love to talk about the political theology. I don't know, Borzoi, if some other time, somebody do so. Yo, somebody grab a rock already.
Perhaps on my roots of the right or a hyper podcastism.
Yeah, either one of those would be great, or like a reboot of Westward or something. Sometimes I think in the near future we should do that because it's definitely worth it.
Did you mean reboot, like as in re with like five E's?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do want to mention I brought up earlier our kind of like allied group guys you should check out. Tazziarch Press. They're doing in late October, they're going to release Othmar Spann's The True State, Liev Tikhomorov's Why I Ceased to Be Revolutionary and Beginnings and Ends, and Konstantin Leniev's Byzantinism and Slavdom. They're very huge brains if you're interested in that kind of stuff. Imperium Press, who have been around for a little bit, are going to release pretty soon a work by Magistre and Carlyle, or a separate piece by Carlyle. And then Rogue Scholar Press, who are our new best friends. I believe they did some Mishima for a short time, or they wanted to, or made an effort to. They're doing some Giroux Les Rochelles, if you're interested in those kind of things. we don't name other publishers, you know, other than those guys, because no one else, we make sure people want to be affiliated with us before we talk about them. But there are other guys we also like. If you want, ask us if we have a book, please do check with other people. There are often people already doing edgier stuff in print, and we don't want to step on their toes.
Well, it's mighty wide of you.
Yeah.
So would you say you see yourselves as like a what is this, like the Taco Bell medium edge sauce?
Well, I mean, it's all about preservation for us, really, getting it into print. So if it's into print, we just got to get it in there, you know? It's basically, you know, we kind of see ourselves as filling a gap of, I don't want to say we're trying to avoid, like, edgy stuff. It's just that, like, books that go out of print, they're whole-length novels. How like, edgy can, you know, 200 pages of anything be? You know, it's pretty dry, usually, you know. But yeah, there's other people filling those niches, and you know, I think we're content to let them have those.
Sure.
Oh, understandable. Don't want to step on toes. All right. But yeah, you know, if you do think of anything else as well that you know comes topically, you know, a book to shill or you know something that's relevant, you know, please feel free to chime in, Louis. But I also wanted to make sure we had time for your table of contents, you know, for the stuff that you wanted to discuss.
Yeah. My winners and losers,
So why don't you lead us off with your winner? Lead us into it.
Yeah, so if we're going to put this out as a Twitter thread, but, you know, we can also just, our Twitter is used for, occasionally we talk about movies or stuff we like or just things we're interested in. And, you know, I've been very interested in the Middle East. I was a Syria war watcher back when that was a thing, even before I was red-pilled. And, you know, we've been watching the Afghan war with a lot of interest. And in late August, something very interesting happened, and the Taliban won the war. We'll do a thread on this on Twitter pretty soon, but the Taliban released a video of them doing something that they hadn't done since the war started. And it's very indicative of how the war's going. And yes, I was on SG, as the chat asked. The Taliban released a video of a military parade, a full dress uniforms, Jeeps, Humvees, Hiluxes. They had a whole military parade in an area they controlled. And that basically means that the Taliban is now able to operate with impunity, and they have such good, tight control of, you know, their operations. They don't fear infiltration at all. They've purged any kind of disloyal traitors who were, you know, wavering, that they can just line up 100 vehicles full of guys in dress uniforms on a road in Afghanistan and do it for the cameras, which means, in short, that the U.S., you know, has basically given up or doesn't have the will to, you know, enforce itself. And in the comments of this video, you can actually find boomers saying, well, one Apache helicopter could light it all up and blah, 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 like all this kind of rabble stuff. But the thing is, the crucial part of the video is that there's not an Apache there, right? It's not there, which means, you know, essentially the U.S. is lost. And that kind of status in those areas of the U.S. being utterly unable to enforce its will is only going to get worse and worse. One other thing is they had a lot of captured U.S. equipment in that parade, so they're obviously flexing.
Not that we would know, but I would presume that was captured from our so-called allies in the so-called Afghani army, as opposed to captured from U.S. soldiers directly.
Presumably, right? But also they could have purchased it from them. Yeah. They could have just bought it from them, you know.
and Raytheon makes a profit, and what's the matter with that?
The other thing is that they also just in general, we'd do a whole thread on it, they looked much better. They were all like, generally you see Taliban fighters, they're like, you know, from like 12 to 70 in all manner of you know, weird dress, you know, usually like, you know, captured old or BDU uniforms. In this video they're all in dress uniforms. They're all military aged, you know, or normal military aged. They have good trigger discipline. They're not like, you know, lounging around with their, you know, fingers on RPGs and stuff. And they look very good. And, you know, the U.S. does not have the ability to do that kind of equivalent in Kabul, you know. And someone in chat said, where's the video? It was on Twitter in late August when this happened, and we're going to put it in our Twitter, in our little Twitter thread we have on this incident. But we think that's, you know, so the Taliban are the winner for me. And, yeah, that's...
Well, here's an interesting thing on the Taliban, actually, since I was kind of curious about what was going on in the war in Afghanistan. So this is an opinion piece from the New York Times. Who's Islam? The new battle for Afghanistan. Finding common ground and the role of Islam is the most decisive task in the peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government. I'm going to skip ahead to... because it's kind of giving a recap of what's been going on at the peace talks and all that. So... where is it? So, establishing an Islamic system of governance is now the thrust of the Taliban's demands as it negotiates with Afghan officials and representatives of the political opposition. But the Taliban need to clearly detail their ideas about the role of Islam in society and governance. The country already has a constitution that holds Islamic jurisprudence above all other laws. Afghan officials consider the character of their system sufficiently Islamic. Their emphasis in the peace talks is on protecting the gains of the last two decades, including women's rights, freedom of expression, and electoral democracy. If peace is going to result from these talks, these two perspectives on what Islamic governance in Afghanistan looks like will need to be reconciled. What is it about the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan that the Taliban rejects so vehemently? The Taliban says the current system was created under the shadow of Western military forces, caters mainly to Western norms, and gives an insufficient role to religious authorities. I have interviewed members of the Taliban and its leadership over many years. They see the Kabul government elites as secularists who seek to westernize Afghan society. Instead, they see the active promotion of Islamic values and morals in the society as one of the primary functions of a true Islamic government. In my interviews, the Taliban cited as un-Islamic the absence of gender segregation in the current Afghan public sphere. They see the relatively free Afghan media as encouraging moral corruption, and they object to the banking system designed on international rules and want Islamic banking.
They want
That's a big thing.
They want a greater role for religious leaders in policy and lawmaking and greater promotion of religious education. Many Afghans fear that the Taliban favor a return to their heavy-handed rule of the late 90s. It is true that the Taliban are uncomfortable with the liberalizing society, with degrees of freedom of expression, lack of gender segregation, and westernizing influences that has flourished in some parts of Afghanistan in recent years. But there are hints emerging from Taliban ranks that they could be influenced by public opinion, perhaps allowing room for compromise. For instance, the Taliban now allow schools for girls in areas under their control where there is strong popular demand. It is a break from the strict rules restricting education for women during their earlier rule. The Taliban banned technology and communications during their earlier rule. Oh, let's see. I didn't realize Taliban was Pine Tree Gang. They have become pretty proficient users of the internet and mobile phone technology, and in some areas the group controls today. When local elders petitioned for their community's internet access, the Taliban granted it and guarded the telecommunications towers. The Taliban seem to understand that they need to go further than tolerating girls' education. Last month, Hibatullah Akhundzada, the leader of the Taliban, deputed Malawi Abdul Hakim, the movement's senior most religious scholar, to lead the Taliban negotiators in Doha. Mr. Hakim has no experience in political negotiations, but the personal involvement of such an authoritative religious figure seemed to suggest the Taliban intend to clarify their positions on the role of Islam in governance after the actual negotiations start, and that they will want to convince Taliban fighters that any agreement signed by the group's leaders will uphold Islamic values.
Yeah. Well, so let me get this straight. They're basically, you know, they're anti-technology. They're not a big fan of banks. You know, they're really uncomfortable with liberalizing the media. Like, I don't know. I didn't expect this to be such great PR for them.
They're basically just a an extremely online Twitter account with guns.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting, an interesting shift. So if have any of y'all read the Afghanistan papers? They were a kind of bunch of leaks, I believe it was last year, about, you know, how the war is actually going. And one of the really interesting things was in about 2014, the Taliban contacted the U.S. through back channels and offered a peace deal, which was the Taliban because they were a police, effectively a political party before the invasion, they would put down their arms and be allowed to operate as a political party in Afghanistan, right? And they just went, basically they said, hey, we're not going to give you our guns. We're going to stop carrying them around. We're going to bury them. And we'll just, you know, we'll stand in elections like a party within your system, right? And that was in 2014. And the U.S. rejected it, you know, trying to go for total victory, whatever that is. And now in 2017, the Americans offered effectively those terms back to them, right? And they turned it down because they're winning again, right? And the idea that, you know, that they're going to win the war. They're going to, you know, take the capital city and set up a government at this point. That's just the way it's going to be. And they feel very comfortable with that. And now they have, one thing in that parade that I forgot to mention was, it was a kind of a flex or a joke even. They had a truck with a 20-millimeter anti-aircraft cannon, some old Russian, you know, very, you know, like anti-helicopter, really, AA gun. And they aren't saying with that that they have the ability with that gun to shoot down planes, but they are implying that they have the Iranians have been sending them more serious stuff, that they've managed to down CIA listening planes and within recent months, and so they're basically implying that they're going to be able to have more and more anti-aircraft help, and then that the U.S. is going to have to rush to a peace deal. There's a school of thought that says the Taliban are going to get more of this gear, and the U.S. should rush a peace deal before they actually lose due to them us losing total control of the airspace, which would obviously be a big blow to the U.S.
Well, I mean, and I guess from where we're sitting, right, like, I don't know, does anybody give a crap if we have to evacuate Afghanistan entirely? Yeah. Like, I view this sort of as a net positive, even if I don't actually care about the Taliban.
I see in the chat someone saying Iran doesn't support the Taliban. That is not true as of the assassination of Colonel Khomeini. How do you ever say it? Hassan Soleimani. Soleimani. Yeah. The Iranians have been, ever since then, they declared they would back the Taliban. That's out of date. The Iranians are now, they're sending them advisors and stuff. It's a bit of a shit show.
I gotcha. I guess to the point, right? Like, is there any reason we should wring our hands, you know, in the dissident sphere, I guess, about, you know, the Afghani people taking back their territory, you know, even if they are kind of like barbaric and we don't care, if we don't want them as neighbors, you know, is there any reason we should do anything but just sort of passively cheer it on as these people, you know, take back their own land?
No, all you should note the U.S. military isn't, you know, there. You can set up communications, you can set up with ways they can't hear you, and you can organize against them, right? If you think that, like, dissidents in the U.S. have, listening by the FBI and wires and stuff on them, imagine what kind of electronic surveillance the Taliban are under, right? And they're, you know, moving around just fine. So it's a solvable problem.
Well, that is an unexpected white pill.
What, what in your estimation are the geopolitical ramifications
of the Taliban winning, or basically winning? Not too much. It'll be probably a hostile country to the U.S. With very little power, much like lots of little countries that hate the U.S. You know.
So you don't think it affects the United States's overall force posture?
We've already been going on kind of a slow decline in the region for a lot of reasons. I don't think we're pulling out of Kuwait because we lose Afghanistan, or pulling out of Syria because we lose Afghanistan. But I think it's just in part of the kind of broad slowdown of U.S. influence in the region that's been happening since 9/11. Or since right after 9/11, it's not gonna. It's on the trend line, right? It's not like a big change in things. It's just a continuing trend.
Well, I'm sure all of the, you know, forthwith after they get seasoned a bit, I'm sure all of the, you know, the hundreds of black female West Point cadets that graduated recently, I'm sure they'll be over there and they'll whip it into shape in short order.
Yep. Yeah. That's that one.
All right. But yeah, the you know, if you'll forgive a bit of a graceless pivot, you know, I think we shorted DK a little bit earlier on some of his prep.
I don't really have a whole lot necessarily. I mean, the
two things we definitely need to talk about are my thing and your thing. We definitely need to do the Bernstein. We definitely need to do this social media app thing.
Which you want to do first?
Whichever. You go ahead and do the Bernstein.
We can do the Bernstein. Althea Julotta Bernstein is, which I saw, I don't know. Oh, man, I should have talked about this. I guess a couple stuttering retards. No surprises here. But yeah, there was a, the journalist who wrote one of the original pieces in the Wisconsin. Let me see if I can find him. But basically, he had a Twitter thread where he was basically saying, like, you know, because people were calling bullshit on this from the very moment that it came out. For those of you out in Rio Rhinelander, this is the story about the half black, half Jewish. I think she was 19-year-old individual who was involved in the BLM riots in Kenosha, and she showed up at her parents' house suffering from burns on her face and having lighter fluid all over her, and her parents were like, what the fuck? And she said, oh, you don't understand, you know, they there were these four frat boys, these frat boy looking white kids, you know, that tossed a lighter into my car and they lit the whole thing on fire. And, you know, obviously this never happened, and it was obvious to anyone who has a brain that this never happened, and it was obvious from the get-go. But the journalist who I'll see if I can find it while someone else filibusters in a minute. But basically, the journalist who wrote this said, you know, somebody asked him immediately, like, this is retarded. This never happened. And he's like, oh, but I have a finely tuned BS detector. And so, you know, there were people dunking on him for his BS detector. Oh,
is that how journalism is done? You just have you fire up the old BS detector, and if the BS detector doesn't go off, you just print whatever you want.
Somebody says something, you know, people are saying, yeah, anonymous sources. So yeah, it's except I guess in this case not anonymous, but yeah, I mean, the big news was that the police department, the Madison Police Department, said that, you know, there was no, after, like, I think basically 2 months of investigation and God knows how many millions of dollars spent and all these interviews and all this time and money wasted, said there's no evidence to support her version of events. They can't corroborate it with anything. They also said, which is, you know, I guess par for the course, but it shouldn't be in an adjust, you know, when we win, it's not going to be like this, that they weren't going to be prosecuting her for making false statements to the police, even though she very obviously did. And the article that we have on this from the Wisconsin, where is this? It's not in the thing. Anyway, it was very equivocal on this point of sort of saying, like, well, there's no evidence to support it, but, you know, they're not going to charge her, so whatever. And it's like, no, they have video of the entire night. Like, everything is very well documented. It's very obvious what happened here. And the only reason they're not, you know, pushing charges, which really what she did was she committed a hate crime. There was a hate crime that was committed, and the hate crime that was committed was committed by this half black, half Jewish woman who committed blood libel against white people, and she attempted to deflect from her own criminal activity, her own, you know, involvement in arson and rioting and in this civil unrest, is I think kind of understates it. This isn't civil unrest. This is an ongoing color revolution. You know, she is a revolutionary. She, you know, in a functional society, she would be recognized as a traitor and, you know, redacted, because that's, you know, what you do with people who are traitors and enemies of the internal enemies of the regime is you redact them. Right. But instead of getting redacted, you know, she's just being, it's not even a slap on the wrist. She's just being let go because, you know, she's a special privileged chosenite, and that's that.
I believe the legal principle they cited for why they're not going to arrest her is it was real in her mind.
I was going to say the idea of like bursting into flame from some, you know, from some frat stars throwing a lighter at you, you know, that is like, that is roughly on par with electrified floors and what have you. So, yeah. You know, there's something to be said for consistency.
Yeah. Well, I thought the legal principle was actually, it was the friend-enemy distinction, right? She didn't attack anyone that wasn't already an enemy. So it's she's a friend, obviously, you know, and she attacked an enemy, so it's okay. No, she's very Schmidian. She's very Schmidian. She's been reading the books.
I think I've got about a 50% of a reason why I don't think she's been reading any Carl Schmidt or any books.
Who would have thought that the drive-by flammer of often wasn't real?
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, the whole thing is
I mean, is, well, I guess I would, what I would say is just if you know people that are for some reason just still not getting it, just show them Jussie Smollett. Show them this.
Right.
They ask them, is this the white privilege you see in action here?
Yeah, and you know, for any of the new guys that just got into this, you know, there's you know, just got into this during 2020 with all the craziness that's been going on. You know, if you're more seasoned, you already know this pretty darn well, right? But like, when you hear about a hate crime, when you hear about something like this on a headline, there is like, you know, within 7 standard deviations of likelihood, it is fake, and you know, the person of color or the rabbi, you know, they. You know, they were the one who actually either fabricated it or did something wrong. You know, these hate crimes are never real.
Yeah. Hate crime hoaxes are born out of hatred for white people.
So I found the tweet. It's by Rob Chappell, and he says, difficult story to write and read. Tremendous courage and grace, though. And then immediately Todd Fishing, who has the pretty funny username of @replyguyrichie, on June 25th. So it's actually been more than three months of, I mean, how much police time do you think, how much taxpayer money was spent over 3 months of investigating? This was, you know, this was an active investigation because they got a Duchess Giulato, Meghan Markle, on the case, you know, to breathing down people's necks about this. Reply Guy Ritchie says, Rob, are you not at all skeptical of her story? It's absurd to begin with, but the photo shows burns on the left side. Did she twist her entire body around 180 degrees and hold still to be sprayed and burned? Or did the, quote, white frat guys aim perfectly through the passenger window? And Rob Chappellwright replies, I'm skeptical of every story, so I did my due diligence. I've been a reporter for many years. My BS detector is very finely tuned, and I have specific techniques that will make me hesitate to report anything I'm less than sure is true. As of writing, he has 48 replies to that, and everybody's just dunking on him. What's interesting, though, is not only has he not gone private, which often when these libtards are owned in this way, they often tend to go private, like that tranny from the other week. He just hasn't addressed it at all. Like, he has said absolutely nothing. This is the guy who wrote the story in, I guess it was Madison, not Kenosha, excuse me. Sorry, Wisconsinites. Yeah, this is the guy who wrote the story in the Madison paper, and he has not only taken no responsibility, he's just like straight up, like, just, you know, not responding to people pointing out that he was full of shit, not responding to people who, you know, called it from the beginning, just completely sweeping on. And I'm sure we'll never hear about this story again, just as we never heard about Cannon Hinnant again, just as we've never heard about, I don't even remember the name of that 5-year-old child who was thrown off the third floor balcony of the Mall of America by that animal. And, you know, these stories just, you know, don't exist.
Yeah. Reading the replies, how come 800 guys called Rape Groiper 5000 could see what you couldn't?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. That's a great question, right?
That's from I want to give credit where credit's due. That's from Project Woody.
Can we? Yeah, I think the you know, the final red pill, right, is like you just ignore traditional journalists, regardless of how fine tuned their BS detector is, and you just get all of your news from racist anon frogs on Twitter, and you're more likely to be closer to the truth than if you actually picked up a paper.
Racist anon frog accounts were. Like, if you would listen to them in December, you would have stocked up on PPE and shorted all your stocks and made a killing. And if you listen to them in March, you realize everything was fake and this whole thing, virus was fake and gay. And, you know, all that PPE, it's good to have for when there's some kind of real emergency. But, you know, it's not like this virus isn't what we feared it was in November, December. So, like, you know, racist anon Twitter has been ahead of the curve by months for, I mean, well, years at least, right? I mean, that's not the only example, but yeah, I mean, like, it's just very clear who knows what is actually happening, who's in touch with reality and who is not.
What I find interesting about these replies now, I don't believe like the normie stirs like in the begins to awake and become based in red pill. I don't believe like that kind of stuff, but there's a reason why like even regular people have no faith in these information institutions. And like I'm looking at all the replies here, and there's not actually that many of our guys like that have become very
Facebag normie cons. Yeah. Not even like cons
per se. Or not even like conservative, normal people, just regular people. I mean, take from that what you will. I mean, we know that media has no, the people just do not trust media, and we know that's across the board. It's just there's no specific demographic that distrusts media. Everybody distrusts the media, and this is.
They're like one of the most. I mean, no institution right now is doing well on the trust scale, but I believe media is above only Congress. Like Congress is like 8%, and the media is like 11%. Was the last I saw of people trust these institutions, and those are the bottom two.
This is one reason why I've seen some people, like in reference to collapse posting, some people compare the United States to what was happening in the decade leading up to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Adam Curtis talks about it a little bit. Well, not a little bit. He talks about it in hypernormalization. That's what hypernormalization was, where the reality that was being constructed by the media within the Soviet Union did not reflect anything that people were seeing on a day-to-day level.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, man. I think we're getting a little bit of a delay. But yeah, I was going to say that to your stat that you brought out, DK, like who in the smoking hell is that 11%, you know, that trusts the media and Congress?
Yeah, just like Jews
are supposed to be 2%.
Yeah, like not even cat. I think cat ladies would trust the media, but not Congress. I don't know, man. Like, I don't know. Yeah. But what I was going to say, the big difference with the Soviet Union, at least as I see it, and Louis, maybe you could chime in here if you agree or disagree, is the ruble was not the world's reserve currency. And the problem that I see, or at least the way I look, you know, kind of biggest picture wise, there's obviously lots of other kind of smaller pieces, but in terms of the bottleneck or the kind of what's going on at the highest level, the thing is, as messed up as the U.S. is in so many ways, you know, people are still paying negative real interest rates on 30-year U.S. debt, which means the U.S. can still borrow, like, effectively, the Treasury by loaning out money is not even not paying interest. They're essentially getting paid to loan out money for the longest term bonds. That incentivizes all the wrong kind of behavior. And as long as that situation obtains, I just, any kind of problem that can be fixed by throwing money at it, which is not anything, you know, not any of the most important problems, but it is sort of the kind of, I think, basic functionality of things like, you know, keeping the lights on, at least to some extent. As long as we can borrow money that cheaply, nothing's going to improve. And the Soviets were not in that situation.
Yeah. Well, I think also one difference that we have this idea that media trust is low. It's kind of similar to congressional trust. So congressional trust is very low, but people, when asked, generally, they almost always, I think, like, if you ask, do you approve your congressman? It's usually like a 60-70% approval. And trust in the media is low, but if I would say, what's your trust in like your preferred brand of news? If I would say, well, Fox News probably has a higher trust scale on Fox News fans, right? So you kind of just decentralize your trust, right, into like what you, you know, it looks like you trust your state representative in Congress, even like Congress. You'll like, you know, I watch MSNBC, I trust MSNBC, even if I don't trust the media in general. I think that's a big difference with Russia, where there was only, you know, if you don't trust Pravda, there's no one to really turn to. But if people are willing to atomize to their favorite news source, so I don't think like media distrust actually matters all that much.
Yeah, it's like Mike always, and it's a great point that Mike always comes back to, is, you know, the problem with communism from our Levantine friend's perspective is that it's one big solid target. The A-B test, where, you know, the capitalism or whatever, neoliberal, global, homo capital, whatever you want to call it, among its other benefits from their perspective is it doesn't give you that one solid target. And usually I think Mike talks about that in terms of things like technology platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and so on. But it's definitely also true in terms of media, because, yeah, you can, you know, when you decentralize the information space in that way, it's like, you know, you can sort of say like, yeah, the media is full of liars and journalists suck, but I'm still going to watch, you know, Fox News or, Rachel, what's her name, or, you know, the Maddow and these people, you know, oh, I like this person. Tucker Carlson, unfortunately, serves that role, I think, for a lot of people. So, yeah.
Cornelius Tacitus says in the chat, TRS is my brand of news. I trust them about 70%.
Hey, man, I think that's pretty good. Yeah, I mean.
Oh, can we? Well, just for the meme, can we lower that trust by 1%?
Nice.
It was funny in my mind.
You're really stepping into the Spectre's roles of just like the terrible dad jokes.
Well, you know, somebody had to do it. And, you know, I may be resented for my role in this transition, you know, into a new progenitor of crappy dad jokes and juvenile humor. But, you know, some
third rail will not survive.
Yeah, essentially. But yeah, I guess the entire conversation, though, we hinted at it, I think, a little bit on the last one with Stryker, the last show. But, you know, just the ghettoization of like where everybody kind of gets entrenched and where they get their information from. Like, I don't know what kind of one of the most unsettling parts of Clown World, I guess, is that I can unironically trust, you know, anon racist, you know, anime avatar accounts for a better reporting of the news than a multi-million dollar, you know, legit news outfit.
So anyway, yeah, I don't know that I have any concluding thoughts on that story other than good job, everybody. Maintain your skepticism. Make sure, I think, Borzo, you made a great point, and it's definitely something that, you know, anytime you're in any kind of situation, like, I saw also a relative of mine, I'm not on Facebook, but I was alerted to by, you know, friend of mine who is that a relative had linked to a Guardian article claiming that there were zero Antifa, or I think it said anti-fascist, but I presume it meant like I don't really know. It says zero Antifa related deaths from political violence in the past 25 years, which, like, first of all, Connor Betts was explicitly Antifa, and I mean just by himself, to say nothing of others, but and, you know, the murders in Chaz and the assassination in Portland of with Aaron Donaldson, I believe was his name, and I mean, there's a lot, and you know, I wasn't going to reactivate Facebook just to argue with this person who would fall on deaf ears anyway, and I'm sure they would find some technical. Well, you know, Betts he didn't carry a card that said, you know, he wasn't paying his dues to his local chapter of Antifa, therefore, you know, something like that, but. With people who maybe aren't quite that lost, you know, if someone does say something or somebody repeats one of those idiotic talking points, this is a great, this and, you know, Jussie Smollett as well is a great example of, you know, the kind of thing that you can push back on those sort of lies with.
Yeah, I've got nothing more to add to that other than what's already been remarked on before, which seems to be the Jew-Lotto seems to be the least trustworthy combination. You know, if these past like 12 months of headlines are any indication.
Yeah, as soon as you see the Giulotto involved in the story, it's like that's when your BS detector should be like maximum, you know, 11.
The BS detector should be going off loud like a bomb, if you will.
Okay, so do you want to go to the social media story, Borzoi? Or?
Oh, yes. All right. Exclusive social media app Clubhouse had an anti-Semitic meltdown over Yom Kippur. The invite-only group voice chat app tried to have a conversation about anti-Semitism that quickly turned anti-Semitic, including Holocaust revisionism and claims of Jewish economic domination. Can the platform avoid situations like this in the future? By Yair Rosenberg. And there's some screenshots that they took from Twitter of Jewish people that were complaining about this, and I'll just read these. Enters join Clubhouse. Here's non-Jewish folks. One, non-Jewish folks redefining anti-Semitism. Two, Jews are the face of capitalism. Three, Jews are weaponizing anti-Semitism. Four, non-Jews asking Jews to tap into unlimited emotional labor to educate. I'm done. I may be just about done with Clubhouse. Twitter has its problems, but it has never made me cry like this platform has. Anti-Semitism and whitewashing the murderous conduct of the USSR are given a complete pass. Oh, this was a quote tweet of, I had to leave. I felt like I was drowning. Have been having conversations with many Jews as of late who have had their bags packed and are ready to flee. This certainly validated those feelings. This makes my heart hurt and my stomach ache. This room was launched while many Jews in North America, including me, were still actively fasting and praying and not on social media. The amount of falsehoods being spewed is abominable. And the last one here, here's the original tweet and then the quote tweet. There's a room on Clubhouse right now that is literally just a bunch of people talking about why it's okay to hate Jews, so I'm done with that app for a while. I went straight to the app and found this room and listened for a while, wondering, I get this, that this topic is tricky, but I don't see what SM was referring to, but then, boom, people holding space and making the case for anti-Semitism. It's not the platform. Also, it's the platform. So, here's the have I wet your beaks a bit? Shall I go to the article?
I just
want to
point out that for those of you listening, the person who talked about Jewish folks used F-O-L-K-S instead of the woke F-O-L-X, and therefore not efficiently... You got to do better. Got to do better.
Yeah. Also, if you're not familiar, Clubhouse is really weird. It's like it's basically Discord for libs. It's just like it's basically you join on and you pop into a server and just talk with people randomly. It's a bizarre service.
Discord for libs. I talking about like the non-furry, non-tranny libs. Is that what we mean?
Yeah, yeah. For like New York Times readers.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Clearly, the nefarious Curtis Yarvin, the author of Culture of Critique, is behind all this. An iron law of the internet is that it is only a matter of time between the creation of a social media platform and it being used to spread anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. In fact, I'm just going to note that platforms probably will be anti-Semitic before they become. Pornographied, I would wager at this point. In the case of Clubhouse, an invite-only communal voice chat app popular among the Silicon Valley set, we now know exactly how long. The audio-based social network isn't even publicly available yet and has already had its first anti-Jewish eruption. Clubhouse, which is currently valued at $100 million, is an exclusive app that allows users to participate in topical voice conversations controlled by the moderator who launches them. Its approximately 10,000 users include everyone from venture capitalist Mark Cuban to actors Jared Leto, Ashton Kutcher, and Kevin Hart. The platform's... Imagine just like hopping through a chat hearing Jared Leto and just starting to talk to him about Hitler. The platform's... Audio-based culture offers a human touch and sense of interpersonal connection that its text-based competitors lack. Anyone who's played Xbox Live with a bunch of teenagers could have told you exactly how this was going to go down. At the same time, the app's dynamic, freewheeling nature poses unique moderation problems, as became evident this week. On Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, a group of predominantly non-Jewish moderators convened a chat room on Clubhouse titled Anti-Semitism and Black Culture. The very framing of the conversation betrayed that it was not being run by those well-versed in the sensitivities of the subject. First, the title pit two minority communities against each other, rather than couching the issue carefully and constructively. Second, there was the date, Yom Kippur, an unintentional oversight that ironically underscored that the people starting this conversation desperately needed to have it, but also weren't remotely qualified to lead it. I don't know what it says that when Jews disappear for a couple days, so people quickly convene to talk about them.
Can I also just chime in and say that they have like 6 million fucking holy days on their calendar. So like, I don't know, anytime you tweet something out, like, you know, you got a coin flip chance that it's on Rosh Hashanah or the day where they like killed the Amalekites or you know, the whatever. So there's always, you know, it seems like every other day is literally some new holy day, some feast day for them.
Yeah, we might need to start working on the Amalekite Lives Matter. Unsurprisingly, given the discussion's charged framing, it quickly became one of the most popular rooms on the exclusive platform, drawing 350 simultaneous users and hundreds more who filtered in and out over the course of the multi-hour Monday conversation, including investors and people who work for Clubhouse. This is, by the way, why Jews generally don't like people talking about them, because once the avenue's put out there, people are interested in talking about them.
I also want to say, I mean, notice like where this is going is if a Jew isn't in control of, like, the problem is that there exists in principle somewhere, somehow, that people are talking about Jews in a way that a Jew doesn't approve of, right? And so the solution to this, obviously, is every single platform, every single channel, every single everything, there has to be a Jew given veto power over what is being said in that channel.
Also,
Gilbert Salgado, I don't know who this guy is. I think he just wandered into our chat, because earlier in the chat he was talking about how the most important thing threatening facing humanity is climate change. Has just commented, this channel reeks of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
stick around, Gilbert, you might like what you hear.
Yeah, if you ever wanted to wonder if you know, Silicon Valley startups are vastly overvalued, this platform is valued at $100 million and has 10,000 users. That valuation is $10,000 per user on this platform. That's hilariously inflated. There's no way it's worth that.
Oh man. Let's see here again. The discussion began constructively, but quickly devolved into a stream of common anti-Semitic tropes about Jewish money, economic. Oh, there's hey, knock it off. Sorry, the dog, the puppy came over here and he wants attention. Let me try this again. The discussion began constructively, but quickly devolved into a stream of common anti-Semitic tropes about Jewish money, economic and political domination, and the Holocaust. Or as one Jewish attendee put it, an airing of grievances against Jews. Audio provided a tablet by a non-Jewish participant of color who was deeply troubled by what they heard feature speakers continuously equating Jews with whiteness, erasing the experiences of non-white Jews, some of whom were in the room, and of Jews in general at the hands of white supremacists. One non-Jewish participant repeatedly declared that Jews and blacks do not have the same enemy, apparently unaware of the alt-right marchers in Charlottesville who chanted, "Jews will not replace us," or the racist gunmen who massacred the congregants of Pittsburgh's Tree of Life Synagogue. Jews were continually stereotyped as uniformly wealthy and presented as the face of capital, according to several Jewish and non-Jewish participants. Multiple individuals justified anti-Semitism by saying it was a way to protest against capitalism, reported a non-Jewish attendee who spoke to Tablet.
Well, I'm not going to lie, this is all a great advertisement for me to get a Clubhouse account ASAP. If they were trying to do some like low key advertising, I guess, to, you know, and putting it in the one place that you know, dissident anti-Semites would see it in Tablet Mag, you know, this might be just like the greatest product placement of all time.
All right. Part of the central claim was that the black community deserves reparations while the Jewish community does not, because the Jews control the banking system. And as a result, the Holocaust was a primarily economic act, based on race or faith.
Wait. Hold up. Now that's funny. But what exactly is it that Jews would get reparations for?
But I like the idea that I'm amused by this idea that the Holocaust was a primarily economic act. It was the genocide of the bankers, I guess, is that the way that this is being framed now?
Yeah. That's a level of racist libertarianism I'm not comfortable with.
Man, never forget the 6 million capitalists that were put in the camps by Hitler. Part of the central claim, let me just read that again. Part of the central claim was that the black community deserves reparations while the Jewish community does not, because the Jews controlled the banking system, and as a result, the Holocaust was a primarily economic act and not based on race or faith, explained one Boston-based entrepreneur. So, kind of trafficking in basic anti-Semitic stereotypes. One participant named Carlisle, well, I told you Bulldog was behind this. One participant named Carlisle claimed that World War II was fought on behalf of Jews, implying Jewish political control of American politics and war-making. In reality, Roosevelt rebuffed the desperate entreaties of the Jewish community to rescue Jews from the Holocaust and only entered the war after the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Okay, whatever. Sorry, go on. That's just that's a non sequitur. Like, okay, he didn't have the political capital to allow specific groups of specific Jews from settling in the United States. That doesn't mean that, like, it wasn't fought on behalf of Jewish. I mean, as a historiographical matter, it may or may not have been. I mean, you can make maybe good arguments on both sides, but this is just a non sequitur.
Yeah, I mean, why they didn't, a large reason why they didn't accept those refugees is because the American public was against it. Like, Jonathan Wiseman complains about this in his book Semitism, where he talks about the polling from that time period when the American people were deeply against allowing in what they called Eastern European refugees, but the American people understood exactly what that meant. Maybe not the full implications of that, but they understood when quote unquote Eastern Europeans arrived, trouble comes with them. Let's see here. Speaker insisted that they could not be an anti-Semite because they were also a Semite. Anti-Semitism is a term that was popularized by German anti-Jewish activist Wilhelm Marr to give his Jew hatred a scientific veneer, and has never referred to non-Jews. And when Jews tried to correct his claims, they were accused of trying to weaponize anti-Semitism to silence him. In actuality, the people who weaponize anti-Semitism are anti-Semites. Several other users repeatedly expressed anti-Semitic myths pertaining to the state of Israel, claiming they were merely anti-Zionist and not anti-Semitic. Palestinians are essentially enduring mass genocide, said one in audio obtained by Tablet. In fact, the Palestinian population has increased fourfold since Israel's founding in 1948, according to the official Palestinian Bureau of Central Statistics. I love all these little asides that they keep throwing in here.
Well, I was going to say, if that's okay to use for the Palestinians as like a shield, right? Like, I don't know, how much is like the black population in America, or the population, like the BIPOC population anywhere, grown since 1948. Is it all right for me to cite that? I mean, I know the answer. It's a rhetorical question, but yeah.
Does that mean then the Japanese are undergoing a genocide since their population actually is shrinking?
My head just exploded. Yeah. No. Right. Well, this is why it's so important to attack these constructs, like, at the level of their premise, right? You know, in other words, the idea, you know, when people talk about the Holocaust or genocide or whatever, be like, okay, well, what does that even mean? Because if it means a population shrinking, the Japanese are shrinking, right? What are you even talking about?
Oh, I was just going to say, I was particularly excited about the next bit. I was reading ahead in the article on this one.
Multiple participants claimed that American police learned how to enact violence on African Americans from the Israeli Defense Forces. We will never talk about the IDF training police officers that are killing black kids, said one. This anti-Semitic canard, which offloads the blame for centuries of American racial violence and police abuse onto unrelated Jews thousands of miles away, has resurfaced with the murder of George Floyd and has been exhaustively debunked by journalists.
All I have to say to those journalists who exhaustively debunked it is, I got bad news for you, bucko. My BS detector's going off.
Just as troubling as these outbursts was the fact that they largely went unanswered. A small number of Jews, several having just logged in after Yom Kippur, attempted to interject their perspective into the conversation, but they were quickly overwhelmed by the torrent of misinformation, which continued to flow unhindered by the moderator. See, once again, you have to put your faith in the grugs. The grugs can get things done. People did refute things, and people did present counter-arguments, and they did object to certain things, but not in a way that really signaled to enough of the audience to make people feel that this wasn't okay, said coffee entrepreneur Nick Cho. Ultimately, most Jewish participants left the room. It was the classic sort of thing where someone says, I'm not racist, but, and then says exactly what the racists are saying, recounted Cho. This mixed poorly, he said, with the youth and inexperience of the chief moderator, anarchist activist Ashoka Findlay, who allowed such users to hold the floor rather than challenging them. It creates a certain kind of energy that either you're prepared for or you're not. Oh, so they're getting a taste of blood sports. I gotcha. As a Jewish participant named Julian explained in a follow-up conversation with the moderator, the thing thing I kept thinking is imagining a room where it was Asian people in anti-blackness and 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different Asian people articulating what their problem was with the black community. And if that happened, I would think it was super effed up. And I would be incredibly annoyed that a moderator would allow that to go on. So I feel like that theme got going, and there were multiple times to stop it, and it was disappointing that it didn't get stopped, and it just kept going and going and going and going. Or as another Jewish participant put it to me afterwards, everyone's like punch a Nazi until it's time to stick up for Jews, and then everyone's silent. Finley later apologized to Twitter to anyone who felt threatened or harmed by anything said in the CH room I started tonight. Although this was a particularly high-profile instance of anti-Semitism on Clubhouse, Jewish users said it was not an isolated incident, merely a more noticeable one. I have never heard the Rothschild and Fed conspiracies mentioned so many times in my life as I have in the past 2 months on this app across rooms, said one. Clubhouse is currently in beta and hasn't yet been rolled out to the general public. The question is, can it adjust to make situations like these less likely to recur. Users were split on the subject. Some argued that better moderation in real time, enabling individuals to flag problematic content, could improve the platform. Right now, one participant in the anti-Semitism discussion noted there's no ability to real-time report. Folks were reporting the anti-Semitism conversation the entire time, but the way reporting works in this app is that it records audio that gets fed into a customer service queue that gets responded to days later. They just have not invested in community moderation. Another user suggested that the best solution might be for attendees to police their own platform and to be more responsible about which sensitive subjects they broach and how. I would love to see the ability to close a room if enough participants vote to do that. I would hope that the individuals don't take on topics as delicate as this without education, forethought, and care. But this is the internet, and that's a big ask. But others were more pessimistic about Clubhouse's prospects. It's not the social network's problem. It's a human problem, said Joe. There is a point at which you can't engineer your way out of the human condition. Hearing someone's voice makes conversations on the platform feel more immediate, he explained, but also more threatening when they go off the rails. The thing that makes it really wonderful and creates all these connections is exactly the thing that makes it more damaging, and it's something that's not cool, Joe continued. I believe ultimately it's not going to last as a platform as a result. I don't think this concept can withstand humanity.
Well, I don't know. All I'm hearing is, it sounds like the invisible hand has spoken. It sounds like there's in this particular platform, in this particular place, there's a demand for conversations about how, blacks deserve reparations and Jews don't and all of that stuff.
Now I need to go and download Kvetch House and go start a room.
All right.
What is interesting is that the high status tech person, in the exclusive moderator, for a long time that was a libertarian, was like the example of that was all these tech libertarians, and now it's tech anarchists apparently moderating these things, but it's the same results.
Well, this is and what you're seeing as well is because wealthy Jews and liberals, white liberals, have often used, whether they realize it or not, what they're doing, that basically POC are cudgels, but they've always maintained a level of separation from them. It's like the whole thing of like moving people into different neighborhoods or into different businesses, and even if they work or live in those same areas, their interactions actually quite minimal, and they often manage to gate themselves out. An app like Clubhouse, especially when they've been diversifying tech, makes that unavoidable. Now they have to actually talk to these people now, because these are not often like hand-picked, hand-chosen, like, okay, we know these are people who have the right opinions that we can shape. No, like now they're actually having to deal with their own rabble.
And and speaking of the rabble and what have you, just to reissue a quote that was in the article, I'm still just laughing over here. I've had to mute myself a couple of times, but one guy's remarking 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 different Asian people articulating what their problem was with the black community. I have this image in my head that's just the Borzoi family reunion over there, just a bunch of gooks bitching about this and that. About the Braca peeper. But yeah, what's the final word on this, I guess? That Clubhouse shortly forthwith will not be valued at $100 million. I think that's what I'm taking away from this.
Yeah, so I figured people would get a kick out of that story.
Yeah, that was hilarious. And it just goes to show you, like, again, take heart because unless they achieve a degree of control that they're simply never going to have, I just don't believe that it's really logistically possible to completely shut down everything all the time. Like this stuff is always going to creep back in. It's always going to cause headaches for them. And the reality is that the efforts to control it, it starts in tablet and maybe it filters its way through, but eventually there's going to be a reaction and, white liberals can be guilt tripped into certain things, but the Black Brown Alliance has no time for that. They don't care. They don't even really have the historical consciousness or the agency to really process, this idea that the Holocaust is the worst thing that ever happened to anyone ever, and therefore Jews have to have a veto power over anything that's ever said anywhere. Like, that's just not, it's not going to work. So,
well, I've learned a lot today. Like, the Holocaust was the result of people being targeted economically.
Yeah, capitalist.
It was just a big insurance claim. That was the real Holocaust. All right. But I was going to say, if we've, I think we've kind of reached a natural stopping point. We've
had about
2 hours and all that. If I haven't cut anybody off, just going from left to right on my screen, let's give some closing thoughts and any plugs that we have. So Borzoi, what you got?
So I believe on Thursday we're going to finally record the Christopher Lash episode of Hyper Podcastism. DK Blauer and I are going to do a pause button on the movie In Education, but we're having some scheduling issues with that, so I don't know when that's going to happen. But that's two of the main things coming up.
All right, awesome. And DK, what about you? What do you have to plug?
Nothing at the moment, but I will be, whether Roots of the Right or Hyper Podcastism or Westward, we're still aiming a comeback episode. We will be I think an episode on political theology is in the near future.
Oh, that sounds fun. All right. And Louis, I know there's the obvious plug, but any last minute shilling or shout outs you want to give?
If if you want to support us, buy our books. If you want to help out or translate or have an original work, you can contact us. The worst we can say is no. Also want to shout out to our affiliated guys, Tazziark Press, Imperium Press, and our Rogue Scholar Press. All very creatively named guys. They're all good guys. We like what they do. If you have any, if the chat has any questions, I can knock them out real quick. But I think we covered most of the obvious ones. Follow us on Twitter as well for updates.
Two very quick things. In the chat, the Bowden episode I did of E-Girl Mafia, that's going to be episode 5. They apparently record a number of episodes in advance. I don't know when they're releasing it. Just keep an eye on Grebe's Twitter, or Enzo's Twitter. Episode 5 will be the episode I'm on, and people in the chat were asking about my dog. It is a German Shepherd.
That's fitting. All right. And then, thank you as always to TV's Frank, for helping produce the episode and all the tireless work he does behind the scenes that, I wouldn't even know how to tackle. Put a bow on it. I don't have anything to plug other than, the third rail, obviously. And as always, encouraging the listeners to go to church. So, Frank, let's go ahead and let's put a bow on this. And remember, the real ethno state was the friends that we made along the way. See ya. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.